Welcome to the closing episode of the podcast Against All Gods. As I've explained several times, this is a 10-episode podcast set within the banner and under the kind of name of the Extra Point Podcast. And now we arrive at the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, chronicled for us in Exodus 11 and 12. And I would remind you, we're 9 plagues in now. We've arrived at midnight. There have been 9 warnings, 9 demonstrations of divine power, 9 opportunities for Pharaoh to release the people of God, to obey Yahweh. And he's refused every one of them. Now we come to the event that the entire plague sequence, the entire plague narrative, it's been building towards this, the death of the firstborn. And I want to spend some time today not sensationalizing this plague, but I want to try to understand it, because this event is, it's not a moment of divine violence that we need to explain away. It's actually the culmination of a carefully constructed theological argument and framework. And in a very real sense, in a very deep sense, the gospel's in view here. We see the gospel in shadow form here. And this moment carries over perpetually, not only to Israel in the future, but even to God's people, the new Israel, Jew and Gentile. So let me just kind of walk you through some history about the firstborn, because I think that will help us understand this plague in a deeper fashion. To understand the 10th plague, we must understand what the firstborn represented in the ancient Near East and Egypt specifically. The firstborn son was the heir. That's not unusual. That's something that even was outside of Egyptian culture. But in Egyptian culture, still, he was the continuation of the family line. He was the inheritor of the father's name and the father's estate. He'd be considered the guarantor of future generations. But where it gets even more Egyptian is in this manner, that in Egyptian theology, Pharaoh's firstborn was not merely his son, he was also the heir of the god king. He's considered the son of Ra. He's the future divine embodiment of, yes, royal power, and in the Egyptians' mind, divine power. So his life was bound up not only with the life of the false deities, but if he did his job well, then he'd be blessed. And so the life of the nation was tied up in the life of the son. In fact, Egyptian royal inscriptions, they often describe Pharaoh as the divine bull, the great son of the god. He was the heir to that title. He was therefore the heir to Egypt's entire theological identity. He was the next deity in line, the next mediator, so to speak. And so to strike him down, it was not merely a cause to grieve on the father's part. This was really a strike at the claim that Egypt's power was divine, eternal, and self-sustaining, that there really were not any gods that were true. They were just simply false gods. And so in this plague at midnight, judgment does fall across the entire social spectrum. Yes, including Goshen, from Pharaoh's house to the house of the prisoner in the dungeon, even to the Israelite houses. Yet it's in Egypt that we know the screaming is heard, because the screaming that rises from Egypt in the night is the sound of a civilization that has discovered its gods cannot protect it from death. This is the ultimate plague, the ultimate judgment, and there is no safety in Egypt's false gods. Now, in this point, we must dwell longer, because this 10th plague is not only judgment. It also has an aspect of mercy in a very concentrated form, a form and a manner in which is very descriptive. You see, Yahweh does not simply kill the firstborn of Egypt and protect the firstborn of Israel by some executive decision. It's not just, whimsical. It's not just random. He actually gives Israel a faith act to perform. You could even say it's a ritual. But within this ritual, this faith act, the entire gospel logic of substitution is encoded. Here's why. A lamb without blemish, one per household, is to be slaughtered at twilight. Then its blood's to be painted on the doorpost and lintel of the house. And when Yahweh, the death angel, sees that, he will pass over that house. Thus, we now know where we get the term Passover, what was celebrated in Jewish culture for years and still is in many parts of Israel. Yahweh will see the blood, and he does not enter that house to take the life of the firstborn. Why? Because a death has already occurred, the death of the substitute. And so the firstborn of Israel is spared. But know this, the firstborn of Israel is not spared because he is righteous. He is spared because a substitute has died in his place. The blood of that substitute marks that house, showing us that a life has already been taken. Justice has already been satisfied for that house. And so there's nothing more to exact. This pattern, a spotless substitute dying in the place of the condemned sheltering under the blood, justice being satisfied so mercy can be extended, that pattern, that's the theological spine of the entire Bible. It runs from, yes, I would say Genesis, to this midnight in Egypt, directly to Calvary, and all the way through the New Testament, even to Revelation, where that's what makes the Lamb worthy. You see, Paul is not being metaphorical when he writes in 1 Corinthians 5:7, Christ, our Passover Lamb, has been sacrificed. He's drawing on history, theology, real time and space, and he's making a typological claim for sure. The Lamb that spared the Israelite firstborn, it was simply a shadow looking forward to the substance of Jesus Christ, God's Son, his death on the cross, his substitution, so that we can be spared judgment. And I think it's important to note here, there is a visible form of faith here. For the Israelites, you had to paint the blood on the door. An Israelite who said, hey, I believe Yahweh will spare me, but I'm not painting blood on my doorpost, that seems superstitious. He would have lost his firstborn. You see, salvation required faith in action, visible. The door had to be marked, and Christ took visible action, marking our door with his blood. And now we, as well, take visible action in responding to the blood he shed for us and making sure we shelter ourselves in his home, the one he's building, his church, and repenting of sin and trusting his death and his shed blood and his sacrificed body as the only means by which we can be saved from judgment. Now, that's a little bit about the history and the meaning of firstborn in the Egyptian theological system and even the biblical system and how they work and how they look and why they are in this place at this moment. But let's be honest, Western culture is also saturated with what we might call a theology of first. And we celebrate firstborns, the front runner, the highest earner, the most followed, the most powerful. And so this idea of first is not new to us. Our entire social architecture, it tends to be arranged in favor of those who are first, who are strongest. But here's what I love. The Passover, it upends that architecture completely. On the night of the 10th plague, the slave in the delta and the royal heir in the palace, they would face the same death sentence. And the only distinction that matters then, it's not bloodline. It's not social status. It's not wealth. It's not education. It's a door marked with the blood of the Lamb. Nothing else mattered that night except the blood of the substitute. You see, there's a radical equality in the gospel that really echoes this. Because every human being, regardless of rank or heritage, social status, wealth, job, address, name your status mark, right? Every human being stands under the same judgment. And every human being, regardless of all those same social status marks, they're offered the same rescue. And that rescue is from the single person and work of Jesus Christ. It's not by virtue of their own firstness, but it's by virtue of Christ's righteousness. And so we shelter under his blood, under his body. We shelter and find covering in another, not ourselves. And so this theology, it's not ancient mythology. This is biblical reality This is true theology. It's what matters most in the universe. And I would urge anyone listening, maybe you've listened to all 10, maybe you're just catching this final one. This final plague really sets the stage for what we know is true throughout the Bible and throughout history. It's the overarching meta-narrative. We are saved by the substitution of Christ, His shed blood for us, His sacrificial death for us. It is His life that gives us life. And so we must trust in Him and find our covering and our shelter in the work and person of Christ, the firstborn of God, so to speak, the Son of God, who died for all who would believe and will not lose a single one of them. His blood, most assuredly, His sacrifice, most assuredly, rescues us from coming judgment and death, but only His does. Well, as this 10th plague ends, Pharaoh rises in the night. He's surrounded by all the dead in Egypt. And somehow in this moment, he calls for Moses and Aaron. He does this before dawn. And he says to them, probably with great anger, frustration, probably in deep mourning, he says, "Get out, all of you, your flocks, your herds, everything, just go." And then he adds this phrase, "and bless me also." That last phrase is quite haunting, isn't it? Bless me also. Like, you find it odd that even in his devastation, this midnight mourning, this before dawn tragedy, he's finding some type of motivation to ask for a blessing. I mean, he's finally releasing Israel, so to speak, and yet here he is reaching towards the very power that has obviously destroyed him. He's asking for something from it. Now, we'll know that he doesn't mean this either. I'm not sure what he's asking for, but we know that by the morning, he changes his mind. He will pursue them all the way to the Red Sea. You see, some hearts are so hardened that even after the ultimate judgment, the death of everything they love, those hearts are still not softened. They're hardened permanently. And yet Israel walks out. This is the moment. 400 years of slavery is now ending. It's under a sky full of grief and through a door marked with blood. As they walk out, they carry the bones of Joseph, a man who trusted a promise he never saw fulfilled. And they walk towards a sea that has yet to be opened. But they are walking out. God is keeping His promises. Fulfillment is occurring. At this point, the Passover is not ancient history. It is the beginning of things that occur in Israel. And it's the beginning of what occurs for us in our regular observance of communion. It's a moment to look back at what really, in some sense, is the hinge of all Christian history for sure. It's what every communion table, where the bread is broken and the cup is poured, it's what every one of those looks to. The concept, the truth, the fact that through the shed blood of a substitute, we are given deliverance and redemption. And in the Christian framework, in the Bible's meta-narrative, that Passover in Egypt was simply pointing to the Passover we would experience when Christ shed His blood and gave His life. And now we find our covering and our shadow under that. That's our redemption. So every time at our church, First Family, when we're lifting the cup and lifting the bread, remember, we are proclaiming the Lord's death, as Paul says. We're proclaiming that until He comes. Yes, the death that was the fulfillment of this substitutionary death in the Passover, that lamb. You painted His blood across the doorpost, and then you were covered, you were protected. Yes, we remember that prophecy. We remember its fulfillment, and we take great joy in the fact that Jesus Christ is our substitute, and we find our redemption and covering in Him.
Thanks for listening to the Extra Point Podcast. To find more content and resources to grow deeper in your relationship with Jesus, go online to firstfamily.church/resources.